This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University Theater Professor Connie DeVere has a new book to coach stressed-out actors.
We can do something to help actors shift their focus from needing to be famous or defining success in a very narrow way.
GLT's Laura Kennedy has more with DeVere about her book, plus Mary Cullen reports on how to stay alive in an active shooter situation. ISU President Larry Dietz gives an update on the university's $150 million fundraising campaign. Hint, it's going well. And Bloomington Alderman Scott Black joins us to talk about eminent domain, raising revenue to fund downtown improvements, and a new way for issues to come before the council. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The city of Bloomington considered the deficit performance of Grossing Arena, the use of eminent domain, and downtown-sourced revenue to fund improvements last night. Alderman Scott Black asked for consideration of several of those issues, and he joins us today. Let's start with the arena, something you did not put on the agenda. Do you believe Venue Works that operating deficits will be on the order of a $500,000 a year going forward?
Thank you for having me, Charlie. You know, we want to see the arena be successful, and when Venue Works came to the council a couple years ago, they managed the building. They said that we were looking in the order of $200,000 to probably $400,000 operating loss per year. And these conversations are always difficult when we talk about the arena. Measuring the performance of the arena can be done in a number of ways. You look at economic impact of the arena, people coming to stay in hotel rooms or having a meal before going to a show. That's not captured in an operating performance. It's just simple what has been brought in versus what has gone out.
So what is a reasonable operating subsidy to gain the bang for the buck on the economic development side that the arena offers?
That is the sweet spot that we have been yet to come upon at this point in time. I'd like to see it run even, but I think that's a little difficult to achieve. And ideally, I like to think about the holistic picture. I've seen numbers range anywhere from a couple million dollars to tens of millions of dollars impact overall for the life of the arena, and that's based on numbers that from the Convention and Visitors Bureau Board, which includes heads in beds, people who go out and have a meal beforehand, and those sorts of things.
Illinois Wesleyan University, as the economics department, did some work on that a few years ago as well. Why do you are they now projecting a $500,000 in the red each year instead of that $200,000 or $300,000 that was discussed earlier by Venue Works?
There's been a lot more information that has been brought forward since then. We know that the attendance at the shows has been a little more sluggish than originally projected. We've had just about the same number of shows as previous years, but the attendance has been a little lower.
Is that the shows? Is that the economy? Is that what?
It's hard to determine that information. And Venue Works and Lynn Cannon do a great job of presenting that information to us and trying to be more aggressive in marketing and those types of strategies. But Alderman Sage last night brought up a good point. I've been on the council now for over 5 years, and I've seen different versions of how we want to see the arena run. I've seen us talk about wanting to have more shows. And so do we add more shows and have less attendance? Do we have fewer shows with higher attendance? Do we take a loss on a show just so the lights are turned on? And I'm not sure that the group as a whole has come up with a solution to that answer.
So what's the way forward?
To me, it's about doing everything we can to make sure the arena is successful. There are those who are very upset with the fact that the arena was built. I understand that, but we have it. We want it to be successful. So if it means that we have to do more shows that bring in more people, let's find out what that sweet spot is. Last night we talked about potentially bringing back EDM, electronic dance music. That was a type of show that we had a couple years ago that would typically sell out. I'm personally in favor of that. I was opposed to eliminating that type of show at the time. Let's get as many profitable shows in there as we possibly can and give people what they want.
One of the reasons some people believe that the arena has not been as close to breaking even as possible is that it was built too small to start with, that it isn't able to attract major shows like some other venues, the Peoria Civic Center, for instance. Do you subscribe to that strand of thought or not?
I do a little bit. I think that we weren't able to find the right sweet spot for the number of seats for the venue. I know that I've seen a number of shows there that have been great, but in terms of attracting the big acts, I'm not sure we're able to do that. So let's find the niche. Personally, I'm not a country music fan, but I know that that typically will sell out shows. If you go to downtown Bloomington when there's a country music show, it's jam-packed. We recently attended the Beer and Bacon Festival a couple months ago. That was sold out. We had a line around the door. So I think it's just finding the right niche in the different types of events that will attract folks to the arena.
How big an operating deficit are you willing to accept?
I want to see it as small as possible. So ideally, I'd like to see it within that $200,000 to $400,000 range as originally projected by VenueWorks. That would be the ideal for me. But I think my goal, Utopia, would be somewhere in the neck of the woods of zero, so it breaks even.
Has this project and its complex history sapped political capital for any new project for a generation or two or however long?
It is undeniable that the arena has sapped political capital for any type of major investment from the city of Bloomington.
How does the city move forward and do what would be advisable to do to remain a thriving community then?
We need to be dynamic, and we need to be looking at all possible options. And I think some of the lingering frustration about the arena is I hear those folks, but we can't linger on the past. We have to be looking forward to remain viable in this economic climate. We have to deal with the challenges of the fact that our state is not the most popular state to be in. We see people leaving. We want to be a competitive, thriving market, and not having projects is not going to bring more people back into our community.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Alderman Scott Black of the City of Bloomington is our guest. You called for consideration of eminent domain in a sense of the council resolution last night. Why was it necessary to identify eminent domain as a tool in the toolbox or to find out the appetite of the council to use it?
Over the past few years, I've been at a number of neighborhood meetings. I've had ward conversations. Individuals on the street ask me, why can't the city do something about X building, or why can't we take care of Y building? And for me to make that happen and have consideration, I need to have majority support. And what better way through our new aldermanic request form process to take a look to see if there is an appetite from the Bloomington City Council to review those types of initiatives.
And are you satisfied with the answer you got? A qualified maybe?
Qualified maybe? I will take a qualified maybe. To me, the aldermanic request form process is to initiate a conversation about topics that aldermen feel passionately about. And based on the conversation last night, I think we gave staff some direction on what we were looking for in terms of making sure that if an opportunity for eminent domain arrives, we should be pursuing that.
In your specification, that eminent domain be considered for potential properties in the downtown, targeted properties, did you go too far, as Alderman Sage had concern about, that was impermissible and that should have happened in a closed session?
You know, there will be those who think that I went too far, and there will be those that thought I didn't go far enough in specifying specific properties. My goal last night was to initiate a conversation about a very controversial and staff-heavy amount of time. An eminent domain process doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long time, costs a lot of money, and to me it's important that before we start moving down that path, a majority of council is supportive of that endeavor.
Okay, by saying targeted properties in the downtown, is that code for the front and center building?
I'm not going to mention any specific properties.
What did you think of Alderman Willambwe's concern about a chilling effect on downtown investment by taking it up in this setting?
I don't necessarily agree with that perspective. I hear Alderman Willambwe's thoughts on that. I think that by having the conversation last night is actually showing that the city is being aggressive and targeting properties that are ripe for potential economic development and can help grow our downtown.
You also issued a call to aldermen to approve staff exploration of how downtown projects are funded in comparable communities. And the idea is perhaps alcohol fees, revenue from the downtown itself. So let's do the chicken egg thing here. Alderman Amelia Burgess suggested it's a good idea to develop projects worth funding and then determine funding. She said there are already a lot of projects identified. So which comes first, the funding of the project?
Having sat around the dais of the city council now for over a half decade, I can tell you that I've had this conversation many times, and I can feel the frustration from folks about downtown Bloomington. I hear people say, why can't the city do more about these sorts of projects? Why isn't the city taking more aggressive action? And when we start talking about a lot of these projects, and the downtown task force did a wonderful job of breaking down tier one, tier two, tier three projects, low-hanging fruit, things we can accomplish, as we start to move up that food chain, they cost more money, and we need a revenue source to pay for that. Based on my feedback that I've heard in the community, downtown should potentially fund itself. And so what are some very specific ways that we can do that? And a lot of these conversations get tripped up when we start talking at a very high philosophical level about what should we do. I'd like to see a more specific, what would a alcohol tax look like? What would a special service area look like? Specific numbers so we can actually have that conversation and not shoot it down before we even get down the road of truly exploring it and what the pros and cons would be.
You didn't get a lot of uptake on that.
Well, no one is ever excited to talk about raising new revenue, and that's okay. What that tells me as part of my goal last night was to get a conversation started about these topics, and I think that now a number of aldermen have mentioned they want to prioritize those Tier 1 projects. I'm looking forward to seeing their alderman request forms with their priorities. I've certainly tried to put mine out there, and I look forward to hearing my colleagues.
So is that a put up or shut up on the on downtown projects?
I wouldn't put it that way.
Why not?
I think about it more as a collaborative process. We have a downtown strategy. We have a downtown task force report. I'm interested in moving projects down the court. I don't want to see us linger and argue about which one should come first. I want to see us grab a majority of aldermen that can agree on one project and see it happen. I subscribe to the philosophy now of the snowball theory, where that if we do a lot of smaller changes, we can make a big impact downtown. And I'm all for it. If it means coming through with new zoning for having sidewalk cafes, retail on the streets, new parking, let's do it. Let's move the ball down the court. And I think we can have some success in that realm.
Alderman Schmidt noted that roughly a decade ago, a special services district similar to what you're describing with a special fee, it really didn't go anywhere. She said the reaction was swift and clear. Why would things be different this time?
Things are different 10 years ago in a lot of ways. I'm interested, and I know that there are going to be people who are opposed and don't want to spend the money, but we have to do something to handle our downtown projects financially. We're not seeing a new revenue come in other areas of the community or the city's budget. We want to make sure that downtown funds itself from my perspective. And I'm interested in having the conversation. It takes political courage to do these sorts of conversations. And I hear everybody talk when they run for office about having tough conversations. Let's have them. Let's do it.
Here is another question, though, that Alderman Burgess raised. Is the underlying assumption with this kind of conversation about a special fee that we can't do anything in downtown without new revenue?
Absolutely not. I think that we need to look at new revenue streams to fund some of the bigger tier projects that we have downtown. I know staff is working very aggressively on some of the lower hanging fruit projects that are being reviewed at this point in time. But we need to have, as a city, a money source that funds some of these projects so that when we do have budget challenges, the fruits of the downtown investments will be paying for future tier projects down the road.
So what now? I mean, you've talked about aldermanic request forms. Do you expect that to move the dialogue to coalescing on a project or two or six of low-hanging fruit or what?
I'm looking forward to, again, my colleagues bringing forward their ideas. I know there's a lot of passion about downtown. I certainly am not going to stop talking about the projects that I think are important. I want to see us try new things downtown. I think it's going to be smaller tiered projects, less expensive, lower hanging fruit. One piece we've talked about is having like a movie night in front of the BCPA, where we project an old movie and have families come out and watch those types of events. Anyone that's been to the GLT Jazz Fest, the Front Street Jazz Fest, any of the festivals downtown, farmers markets, knows that people want to come out to these sorts of events. So let's do them. That doesn't cost a whole lot of money. Those are lower tier projects. Let's get those rolling. Let's see it happen. And I think those will morph into bigger tiered projects over time.
So 5 or 6 minutes, 5 or 6 items of last night's agenda were yours because of the aldermanic request form. How did it work as the first time out for anybody doing it this way? It's intended to streamline and to encourage aldermen to talk about things publicly and in an orderly fashion. How'd it work?
I'd call last night a success, but I'll give it some notes, you know, for the future. As we started to do this new process a couple months ago of having in the committee the whole aldermen have the opportunity to bring up a topic to give staff direction to pursue or not pursue, I think the idea from my perspective was that it would be kind of a high-level conversation to determine if staff should spend time researching and drilling into the weeds. Last night probably got a little bit more into the weeds than I had intended in terms of specifics on these projects, but I think I'm hopeful. I think this is a way for us to have community conversations in public about these big issues.
Did you get the sense that other aldermen were a little skittish about it and wanted to know more about the weeds before they agreed to anything high level?
I think that could be said. I know that if I try to put myself in somebody else's shoes, and I can imagine if I had read some of my alderman request forms, I would have had a number of questions if it were from another alderman. I think that we gave some direction on what we want to do with these topics.
So how will you tweak your request forms in future?
I think what I'll try to do in the future is make sure I circle back with all the aldermen to see what questions they have beforehand. I know that I work very closely with Tim Gleason, our new city manager, and he was fantastic in assisting me in getting through these forms and making sure that he was prepared for last night's meeting.
Alderman Scott Black of the City of Bloomington, thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Off and Running, striving to be Central Illinois' go-to place for all types of runners and walkers by providing top-of-the-line products and service. Free fit analysis to fine-tune running available on-site and more information available at offandrunning.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, ISU President Larry Dietz talks with us ahead of this week's State of the University speech. In this era of high-profile shootings, it's more important than ever that schools train for such a crisis. Illinois State University Police and Emergency Management recently offered active shooter training for faculty, staff, and students. GLT's Mary Cullen reports trainers recommend 3 responses to an active shooter situation. Run, hide, or fight.
A widely reported estimate is that the U.S. has about 1 school shooting per week, though not all are as deadly as the Valentine's Day shooting in Parkland, Florida, in which 17 high school students died. The big number raises eyebrows and alarm at the apparent increase, but details matter. What constitutes a school shooting? What if no one was injured? What if there were injuries but no deaths? The answers suggest a less dramatic picture. Illinois State University Police Chief Aaron Woodruff says there hasn't been a significant increase in school shootings, though public awareness and media coverage rightly draw attention to those that do happen. Every time a school shooting happens, like the one in Parkland, Florida, Woodruff says his phone line is ringing with parents and students asking, "What if ISU is next?" His response is, it's time to focus more on prevention rather than preparation.
When you get on an airplane, everybody's not paying attention, and they give a little seatbelt speech and tell you what to do in the event the plane goes down. And oftentimes after one of these targeted violence incidents, that's the first question I get. People call and say, what do I do if this happens? And what they're asking for is that seatbelt speech. And I tell them, you know, the part they're missing is the prevention side.
At one of ISU's active shooter training events, Woodruff expanded on that airplane example. poll, asking the audience if they could only pick one, would they rather their flight crew check the plane prior to departure or give the seatbelt speech?
One of the things that helps prevent a plane from going down to begin with, and that's some of the basic checks and services for a plane. So I think that metaphor helps kind of bring the importance of prevention to light for people because, again, we're all like that. We all want to know, what would I do if this happens?
Preventing an in-flight plane incident involves testing propellers, checking wings, and reviewing takeoff and landing procedures. Woodruff says preventing an active shooter situation is human-centric.
A lot of people attribute these incidents to mental health, and while mental health may play a role, statistics indicate that given the number or percentage of people that we have in this country with some form of diagnosable mental illness, that doesn't necessarily mean they're all going to commit a violent act.
He says violence is usually the result of unbearable stress.
Everything is always about the totality of what's going on in their life and looking at these things and evaluating, you know, what risk level are they at and what are the appropriate intervention measures? What can we do to reduce or de-escalate the situation to bring them back to a point where they don't see violence as an alternative?
Stress alone does not make an individual likely to commit violence. Woodruff says it's important to recognize the difference between making a threat and someone posing a threat. For example, someone could say, "You better watch out." That's vague, but could be very dangerous. To determine whether the person actually poses a threat, Woodruff says to reply with, "What do you mean by that?
Is it a threat of violence? Is it a threat of something else?" So what we encourage everybody to do is to report any threat, and then we'll evaluate them on a case-by-case basis.
Woodruff says looking at individuals on a case-by-case basis allows police to determine if the threat is credible and how to help that person.
As a university, we'll have a number of other different resources departments we can reach out to find out what is occurring and then determine, is this a credible threat of violence? Is this just a threat of some other behavior acting out?
When it comes to active shooter situations, the state of Illinois recommends run, hide, fight over the lockdown method common before the Columbine High School massacre in 1999. Lockdown advised teachers to corral students into a corner of the classroom, away from doors and windows, with the lights off. The hide of run, hide, fight is similar to lockdown. But rather than having students clumped in masses, authorities urge people to spread out to make less easy targets. ISU Director of Emergency Management Eric Hodges says the idea of run, hide, fight is letting people choose what works best for them in an emergency.
That changes second by second based on where the suspect is. So it's not, you only have the run option, and if you don't use that now, your barricade option is the only one left. You really reevaluate as this incident unfolds.
Illinois will soon switch to the enhanced run-hide-fight method, which encourages individuals to rethink and update their choice as the active shooter situation carries out. Woodruff says active shooters are rare. So are tornadoes and fires. He says school drills for those disasters and active shooter drills are just another precaution.
We practice it for a reason, and we have to be prepared for it, but that doesn't mean we have to be afraid every day that there's going to be a tornado coming.
ISU's active shooter training session shows videos of the run, hide, fight method in use. The method is for use in all settings, not just schools. Active shooter trainee Janine Harvey Northrup teaches in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at ISU. Working in a building that welcomes non-ISU patients and community members, Harvey Northrup says it helps to know Run, Hide, Fight provides options for the department's less mobile visitors.
With all of the uncertainty that's going on in the country right now, it's important that I feel educated and empowered to provide that information to my students and all of the pediatric clients and adult clients that come into our department.
After seeing videos of the Run, Hide, Fight method in use during ISU's training, Harvey Northrup says she feels better prepared to inform her students. With student instructors, she says they are often apprehensive in emergencies where they have a leadership role. Hodges says ISU offers active shooter training to all faculty, students, and staff.
Right now, we offer these in classroom and hands-on methods. We have been talking about perhaps some video series, very short video segments on this, but that's really just a discussion at this point. So right now, our two real options are classroom and hands-on.
The university uses 8 different media to spread emergency information. The most commonly known is ISU Emergency Alert, a program that sends text messages detailing specifics of the emergency.
So what we don't say is there's a fire on campus, evacuate. We say there's a fire in this location. So when the dispatcher is bringing up that script to send, they have to type in that one piece, location, then it can send.
Hodges says their goal is to update emergency alerts every 15 to 20 minutes, but all updates are freshest on the ISU website. I'm Mary Cullen.
Community members and parents can become ISU Emergency Alert recipients by signing up online.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, helping ease seniors transition to retirement living with caring, compassionate move management and relocation services. They understand and address the unique needs of people making this significant life change. Details at lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the actor's life is not an easy one. Laura Kennedy reports on a new book that helps actors in that position. Illinois State University is making progress on its $150 million fundraising campaign called Redbird Rising. It went public with $102 million in commitments, and University President Larry Dietz says they've secured another $23 million in the last year.
To date, we're well over $122 million, so we had our second largest fundraising year in the institution's history this last fiscal year, and so it's really moving along. So thanks greatly to the support of our alums and our friends of the university. We've got more to go, another $28 million roughly to go, but we're confident that we'll not only make our mark, but hopefully exceed our number. And again, it's big thanks to the generosity of our supporters.
If contributions to that effort continue to come in steady Eddie, when would you anticipate declaring victory?
Well, the campaign is really has another 2 years to go. We're going to finish it in 2020. And so we're not going to declare victory earlier than that. And so that's been our time frame, and hopefully we'll exceed our goal. And I really do think that we will. But our folks have been answering the call, but we need more of them to continue to answer the call in the next 2 years that we have left in the campaign. And I'm convinced that folks really think that this is the institution that really gave them a leg up in their careers and within their personal life, and they all each have their own success story, and they've been willing to give back. So we just need more of them to continue to write checks and remember us in that way.
During the spring, when you came up, we asked about the potential for a higher education funding formula. State Representative Dan Brady has said that conversation is likely to begin under the auspices of the Higher Education Working Group, a legislative cohort, a bipartisan group. How are you seeing that conversation mature?
Well, Representative Brady, he's true to his word on that, and that the higher education group has continued to work. As a matter of fact, we've had a meeting here recently within the community, and so they're going to continue to work on that. It's not an easy fix, and it's not something that we got to overnight, so we're not anticipating that we'll work out of it overnight. But the bottom line is that one of the most successful institutions in the state, Illinois State University, gets the least amount of dollars per student than all of public higher education in the state of Illinois, and that's simply not right. And so we're $2,000 less than the next lowest and $3,000 less than the average amount per student. That would equate basically to a new College of Fine Arts every year, about $64 million, so it would nearly double our appropriation. So we're not anticipating receiving that tomorrow, but we would like to have a formula that's fair, one that's updated, and one that we can depend on, and one that is will help Illinois State with the success story that we've become.
Where is ISU in the conversation? How much talk has there been so far?
Well, we've been asked to present information to the working group a number of times, and I think, people get the data. They understand the data. The issue is, where does the money come from? And we were not, it wasn't our institution or any other public university that got us into this financial situation of the state. It's really going to take some will of the elected officials and some good conversation. We're happy to participate in that to try to get a budget, which we have this year, and we're very grateful for that. But that's just 1 year, so we need a budget that is stable, reasonable, and appropriate. And we'll continue to engage in conversations until we get one like that.
You were recently named to a panel of advisors for Google's Illinois Impact Challenge competition, which runs through September 21st. What is happening on that front? What's been your input?
Well, there hasn't been a need for a lot of input in the decision making because our date is not, is approaching, is not here yet. But heretofore, I've been asked to be a part of that, and I'm delighted to serve along with some excellent folks. I'm appreciative of the opportunity to serve. What I've done in the meantime, though, is to kind of get the word out to not only local nonprofits, but I've sent, I've had communication with other presidents and chancellors at other universities in the state, letting them know of this opportunity through Google, and ask them to put the word out to their nonprofits that are surrounding those institutions as well. So what we hope to do is to have a large pool of very strong and diversified ideas from nonprofits that will help drive economic development opportunities throughout all of these different communities. And I'll be delighted to serve on the advisory group that make recommendations as to who will be getting money.
Economic opportunity is a fairly broad umbrella. Could you narrow in on what you consider especially propitious ways to stimulate economic opportunity?
Sure. I had a little difficulty with the same subject until I talked with my contact at Google, who is from this area, and Stephen Brokaw. And I said, my sense of service non-for-profits is they're primarily service organizations and not necessarily focused on economic development. And he gave me some examples that he had come across in other states that really kind of brought this clear to my mind anyway. He talked about perhaps if there were nonprofits that were focused on helping individuals, formerly incarcerated individuals, for example, get enough skill training that they could find a job, that that might be something that would be worthwhile. If we looked at other underserved populations that weren't working because of difficulty getting places and mobility issues and transportation issues, maybe those would be interesting kinds of projects. So I'm really interested in being educated by the process and by the ideas that are going to be coming from the folks. And I have great faith that we're going to get a lot of interesting folks and creative folks that will be submitting proposals.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Larry Dietz is the president of Illinois State University. The Common Application is a single form that students can use to apply to more than 800 colleges and universities. That form will no longer include a question about criminal histories beginning next year. Now, ISU doesn't use that form, but it does raise the question, how does the institution account for people that may have criminal histories who are seeking entry to higher education, and what's the process for deciding whether they can or should be admitted?
Great question, and you're right. We don't use the Common Application, and we do ask the question of individuals who want to become a part of our community as students, whether or not they've had a previous criminal history. And once we obtain that, there's a small group of our staff who get together and make some decisions regarding the environment that that person might enter into. It has nothing to do with their academic qualifications, and so it's not really a group that makes any decision at all about based upon their being admitted or not being admitted to the university.
They also have to have that piece of it to get
That's in. Right. But that's right. But we feel like it's important for the entire university to remain safe, to ask the question, and at times perhaps even restrict access to some portions of the campus, based upon a person's past history. We feel at least we need to know about that to keep the campus safe and reduce the risk inherent with some individuals who we may want to restrict access to facilities, but not necessarily academic access to the institution.
Larry Dietz is president of Illinois State University. He gives his State of the University speech on Thursday. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a report on the technology of abortion. The life of an actor presents ample demands that can tax the hardiest of artists. An Illinois State University theater professor saw the need for practical advice that leads to lasting positive change for actors. Connie DeVere is one of the creative voices behind a new book that addresses the stress inherent in the life of an actor, dealing with self-doubt and creative blocks. But as GLT correspondent Laura Kennedy discovered, the book can offer a helpful and fresh perspective for people in any profession.
In most theater programs, actors learn how to analyze a play, how to handle a stage rapier, how to develop a character, how to audition, and many more skills that will serve them well in the entertainment business. But typically not part of the curriculum are the harder lessons brought by a life in what can be a brutal business. The new book by Connie DeVere and Jan Elflein addresses those lessons. Actor for Life, How to Have an Amazing Career Without All the Drama, takes on self-care for actors as a navigation tool that teaches actors to understand that they have more control than they realize and to not give in to negative emotions and ultimately to make readers winners of the inner acting game. Connie DeVere says she was inspired to write the book after so many times running into former acting students a few years past graduation. DeVere says some of them looked a little sad.
And a little apologetic, like, yeah, well, I'm not really auditioning that much. And I want to say, having walked that walk before, I want to say, first of all, are you happy? Are you a happy human being? That's my first question, because that's what matters. And secondly, it's a process. It's a lifelong process, this acting thing. And it's hard. Like, we haven't heard that a million times before. But then I went, ding, ding, I got certified as a life coach in 2001. And I have a good buddy who's a master coach.
Jan Elflein.
Jan Elflein, my co-author, who's not a theater person. She's a theater lover, but she's a coach. And so I thought, we can do something here. We can do something to help actors shift their focus from needing to be famous or defining success in a very narrow way and supporting a life that's an enriching, fulfilling, creative life.
You know, and I find that very interesting because so much in America, it's across the board that we define success with being famous, with being very well known, with making a lot of money. Nobody says, are you a success? Are you a success because you're happy?
Right.
No one ever says that.
Right.
And you say, we need to be saying that.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, I interviewed 8 actors and 2 casting directors who have some longevity in the field. Jeff Perry, Judith Ivey, Gary Cole.
You've got Gary Cole in here, too.
Yes. Those 10 individuals, first of all, are so generous. They freely gave their time and expertise, and they almost to a person said, young actors entering the field need to define success for themselves. It isn't about fame.
Or an Oscar.
Yeah. It's about making a difference. And in fact, Gary Cole is the one who first said, are you making a difference for one person, at least one person? That's how he measures his own success. And if that's the case, he succeeded.
What did you see really needed to be addressed when you were hearing back from old students? Was there a particular pattern?
Yes. Yes, a lack of agency.
Now, what do you mean?
A feeling that other people are in control of my life as an actor.
Directors,
yes.
You know,
yes.
All that. Yes,
directors. Other people define who I am by my type, by my gender, my age, my color, my size, all of those things, my voice, all those very personal things. Other people can cast me or not. I have no control. And that is patently false from a sort of spiritual perspective in a way.
What is that control that they have?
They have the control to see themselves, create their own destiny, really, define success for themselves, and then take incremental steps, which the book outlines in the exercise portion, take incremental steps to achieve that vision. Also, the industry is changing so much now. With the internet, actors can create their own work with web series.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an iPhone, you can shoot a short film starring you, and you can reach a wide audience. You really do, in a very, very practical, down-to-earth way, have more agency in this decade than actors did maybe 30 or 40 years ago.
One of the things that actors have to deal with a lot is rejection. Mm-hmm. Even though they may be with their agency creating their own stuff on their own platforms,
right,
they still have to go see casting directors and talk to directors, and they still have to face a lot of rejection. What is your advice on dealing with rejection? Because let's face it, it's not just actors who face this.
Absolutely.
This is something that there's advice in Actor for Life that could apply to somebody who's
Everyone.
Working in computers, somebody who's a baker, you know. But I think rejection is a big thing.
Right, right. I wish we could come up with a different word besides rejection.
Because it's so weighted?
It's so weighted, and it's so kind of final and personal. In acting, I think to approach it from a lighthearted place, because it is inevitable. There are many, many actors, right? So casting directors and directors have many wonderful choices, right? So you have to sort of expect it. I think if you go into the business not really believing that rejection is going to happen more often than not, then you're shocked by it. And first of all, you shouldn't be shocked by it, right?
Because there's so many actors and so few parts.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So there are a number of things you can do. One, seek feedback. Get better. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Know that, for one thing, it might be a skill or a technique that you could develop and get better. You could get better at cold reading, for example.
Is that even taught in college?
It is.
Okay.
Cold reading, yes. Those kinds of acting skills are. This sort of the inner game of acting, we don't necessarily have time for, because we're trying to teach the craft of acting itself.
Right. You also write in your book about blocks.
Yes.
And blocks, something actors face all the time, something basically everyone faces somewhere in their
mm-hmm.
life. And something really jumped out at me, and that is people blocks.
Yes.
Which can be very difficult. And you write, sometimes the company we keep is toxic. People can be jealous of you. Maybe they're insecure. Maybe they believe the world is not a safe place. Maybe they're just plain negative. We're not casting blame, but we are suggesting that it is your job to manage the portals of your mind and sort for people and experiences that affirm, enlighten, and promote your health and vitality. And
yeah.
this is definitely a self-care kind
yes.
of thing, and
yes.
a self-editing sort of thing, trying to get the negative people out of your life.
Right. So managing your own thoughts, being attuned to the soundtrack in your head that says, well, why did she say that to me? And why did they, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to sort of take a step back and maybe even, this is radical, but take a moment of compassionate examination of the other to look at what might be going on in their life that would motivate their behavior, so that you don't let your thoughts run away with you. And that's a practice that you get better at with practice. It's just a skill that you can develop. And then the other thing that's difficult is sometimes you need to get away from people who are toxic and negative, or choose when you're going to be around them, because nobody is all bad and all good, right? Some people are great when we're in a great mood and feeling resourceful, and when we're feeling vulnerable, they're not the person that we need to be with.
Yes.
So to discern and suss out the timing of relationships is useful.
What are some of the common worries that consume actors that you can help them with?
Well, one is a sort of undercurrent of lack. I'm not enough. I don't have enough money to get headshots, to take classes. I haven't had enough training. That is a common worry And so, again, it all comes down to managing one's thoughts.
Connie, how would you like this book to be used? Do you see this mm-hmm. as a textbook to be used in classrooms, or is this something more like a graduation present? Now you're done, you've got your MFA or your BFA, here's this book because you're really going to need it.
Yes.
How do you see it being used?
My answer to that is yes.
Oh, all of the above.
All of the above. I think it definitely has a place in a sort of capstone course. We have a class at ISU called Auditioning, where all of our seniors take that course, and it's about the business, right? It's about here's how you get an agent, here's how you do your taxes, all of those kinds of launching one for the business. And so this piece, the inner game of acting, really fits in nicely with that kind of course. And then I also think actors could benefit as they graduate and walk across the stage or handed this book.
Instead of the sheepskin.
Yes, right. Or actors who are pounding the pavement and have you know been at it for about 5 to 10 years and
to
could use a boost.
A fresh perspective.
Absolutely, yeah. And butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers.
Because the lessons you give in here, the advice you give in here, and the exercises that you're suggesting can be applied across the board.
Absolutely.
Connie DeVere, speaking with GLT's Laura Kennedy, says part of what made creating the book so fun was selecting the illustrations, black and white stills from classic movies, featuring performers ranging from Buster Keaton to Lionel Barrymore to Greta Garbo, which all reflect the themes of the text in whimsical fashion. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. President Donald Trump has picks for the Supreme Court that have many people questioning the future of abortion in the U.S. It's an issue that's often talked about in terms of politics. But Illinois Newsroom's Madeline Beck finds technology plays a growing role in access to abortion for both sides of the debate as well.
This story is not about the ethics of abortion. Instead, it's about how technology will influence people's access and decisions. Some of that technology is already out there, like in Planned Parenthood's Iowa City Clinic.
Come on in.
It looks more like a small office than a space for patients. There are tables, chairs, a laptop, a cash register. The room is for telemedicine abortions. That's where women talk with a physician over a computer screen. The physician reviews patient health information, they talk, and if all parties want to move forward, the doctor remotely unlocks the cash register that has one person's abortion medication.
This is just that modified cash drawer technology. These are normal cash drawers.
That's Rachel Goss from Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. She says her organization pioneered a version of this technology 10 years ago. It gives women access to abortion in areas where physicians are sparse, but 19 states have banned the technology. If other states ban abortion in the future and more women head to Iowa clinics with telemedicine, Goss says,
I do think it would actually help us meet the need and demand.
And either side of that discussion, for abortion rights or against, will be using this technology and many others to change the abortion debate, to bring it to a large online stage.
We are able to use those same technologies for pro-life reasons.
That's Mary Kate Knorr, director of Illinois Right to Life. She says clinics that perform abortions may use technology in one way, but her organization uses social media and live streaming video
to reach those same women, to talk to them about their other options, to talk to them about adoption, to talk to them about the various resources that we are able to provide.
And Knorr says new ultrasound technology and detailed images inside the womb help their mission too.
Ultrasounds allow women to actually see something that they couldn't see before.
At Planned Parenthood, Goss says seeing the ultrasounds have convinced some women to change their mind about abortion, but not a large percentage. Ultrasounds may influence people's decisions in another way, though.
It's incredible what we're able to see now versus, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
That's Dr. Andrew Satin. He's director of gynecology and obstetrics at Johns Hopkins Medicine. He sees how technology could affect women's decisions around abortion in another way. Doctors can now see, diagnose, and sometimes cure health issues in the womb that they couldn't have a few decades ago. That's using better imaging like ultrasounds, tiny instruments, and genetics.
I think those are all tremendous technologic advances that will allow us to diagnose things, to be able to counsel patients accurately and hopefully to treat more things, but also to inform them when we can't treat more things so they can make informed decisions.
These technologies may not change people's beliefs about abortion. Groups supporting and opposed to abortion rights may embrace any technology to match their own viewpoints. But these things will play into individual decisions. And there are plenty of other technologies to factor in, too, like contraception apps to prevent pregnancy. And, a ways down the road, possibly drones that could deliver abortion medication to women's homes. Activists have already used them that way in other countries. Goss, with Planned Parenthood, says people within the organization have to comply with state and national law, but they still want to keep expanding access with technology.
It's just, how can we do that, continue to remain compliant, continue to, you know, serve our patients as well as we can?
But for her clinic and for the anti-abortion movement, the real technology that's affecting abortion now is the internet. It's something that wasn't around when this became a big political fight in the 70s. If abortion access changes, women can go online, ask questions, and find answers to whatever they might be looking for. I'm Madeline Beck, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a collaboration of public media newsrooms covering education, politics, health, and the environment. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas and interviews and stories, with help today from Mary Cullen and Laura Kennedy. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.